This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
In which bank might be an economic four-letter word. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday today, the 8th day of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It has perhaps escaped your notice, unless you are a close observer of the regional bank scene, that things have been relatively calm since Silicon Valley Bank and Signature and then First Republic collapsed this spring. Well, that was then. This is now. Moody's has downgraded its ratings on a handful of regional banks, citing interest rate risks and troubled loan portfolios. As Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, a lot of the problems in banking that surfaced earlier this year, they have not gone away.
One of the big issues that Moody's cited was bank deposits. That's because rising interest rates have put pressure on banks to prevent customers from pulling their money.
In order to keep those deposits, they have to pay more for that.
That's Anna Arsov, Moody's co-head of bank ratings. Deposits first started falling about a year ago. But after banks announced their second quarter earnings last month, Arsov says it became clear that banks' source of funding for loans is still strained.
We believe that the system is relatively stable, but those funding strains will continue.
Moody's also said a lot of regional banks could run into trouble with their commercial real estate loans, since many borrowers aren't earning any revenue from all the offices that are still sitting vacant. Stephen Bigger is a bank analyst with Argus Research.
The smaller banks tend to have more of that local footprint, so that makes them a little bit more susceptible to commercial real estate and commercial office space as well.
Bigger says banks are well aware that some of those loans could go bad, and they have been taking steps to prepare.
Adding more to loan loss provisions and doing more on the credit underwriting to make them less susceptible to future problems in that area.
Regulators have stepped in, too, with proposals meant to make the banking sector healthier overall. But Catherine Judge, a law professor at Columbia, says regulators aren't likely to impose any new rules that quickly.
And generally speaking, you don't want to force banks to undergo significant and costly changes during periods of time when credit is less available.
Judge says this week's downgrades are a sign that that period of time is going to last a while, even though this year's big, dramatic bank failures are likely behind us.
We've instead shifted to the mode of the turmoil that is more of a slow burn, where the various challenges that these banks are facing continue to persist.
That means regional banks will keep paying more interest to depositors and lending out less of their own deposits. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Tuesday, nothing to write home about, really. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Sometimes in business, even things that don't happen matter. Case in point, second quarter earnings out today from UPS, which revealed what a lot of people had been expecting, that those rough contract negotiations, the ones where a good chunk of shipping and logistics was going to be shut down if there had been a strike, they had a real impact on the business, even though a deal did get done. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more on what that might say about the company and what it might tell us about the corporate world at this moment.
UPS said its revenue fell in the second quarter as clients worried about a potential strike diverted their business elsewhere. Daily package volume was down about 10%, about a million packages a day. The Teamsters union members are voting on the negotiated contract this month, and UPS Chief Financial Officer Brian Newman said on the earnings call the contract was a win-win. At the same time,
the union wage rate increases included in our new labor agreement for the first year are higher than we originally planned.
And he says that's one reason the company decided to revise its revenue and profit targets downward for the year. Richard Morrison is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Anytime one cost goes up, there's less money to go around for everything else, including less money for dividends for shareholders, less money for things like stock buybacks, although some plenty of companies are still doing those.
UPS is still planning some stock buybacks, and it's worth noting that the company was one of about 200 that signed on to a 2019 pledge saying corporations would commit to prioritizing employees along with shareholders. But, says Peter Capelli, a professor of management at the Wharton School of Business, when you look at the corporate world more broadly,
the deck is still stacked in favor of the investors.
He says most of the moves companies have made in favor of employees have been around wellness, not necessarily wages.
I think what we have seen so far, the extent to which they are doing things which maybe are pushing more money in employee directions, it's because of a tight labor market.
Which can give workers and potentially their labor unions more leverage to press companies on who gets to pocket any profit. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
According to the International Energy Agency, 3.1% of all commercial trucks sold in the United States last year were electric, a small but growing number, and California is driving some of that growth. This spring, the Air Resources Board out here adopted a new requirement that companies with 50 trucks or more have to start transitioning to electric vehicles. They've got, those companies do, at least 12 years to get there, but some companies are already going down that EV road. Aaron Stone from LAist took a ride in an electric semi.
So we always do the drive first.
Edwin Buenrostro moves at a fast pace, using metal hooks to move an 8-foot stack of boxes.
Probably going to push this one.
To keep food fresh, the truck needs to stay running at every stop along Buenrostro's 14-hour shift. He does 11 to 16 stops per day to Starbucks across the city of Fontana. Buenrostro is one of the first drivers behind the wheel of an electric Volvo big rig bought by the company he works for, Quality Custom Distribution, or QCD. It's a division of one of the largest restaurant distribution companies in the U.S. This electric rig is a lot different from the diesel trucks he was used to.
My first thought was how quiet they are. I was surprised because I'm so used to the vibration of the sound, the noise, the exhaust, like the fumes, the heat coming out of the bottom of the cab.
He says one of his coworkers suffered severe headaches from fumes getting in the cab.
So that's toxic for us. You know, we're in this truck 14 hours a day.
Buenrostro says he also feels better driving electric because he's helping the air quality in the local community.
And that's when you realize, hey, man, if we don't do something now, our kids are going to, they're going to feel it, you know, 20, 30, 40 years from now.
California's Air Resources Board says heavy-duty vehicles spew about 9% of the state's total greenhouse gas emissions and nearly half the pollutants that cause smog. That's why the state mandate passed in April requires fleets of 50 or more trucks to be electric or hydrogen powered by 2042. Port trucks, government fleets, and local delivery companies like QCD are required to transition sooner, by 2035. But costs and deadlines concern many companies.
It's a lot of capital right now because the scale's just not there.
QCD Vice President Shane Blanchett says that at about $300,000 each, the trucks cost close to three times as much as a traditional diesel truck. But the company was able to buy them at a similar cost to diesel through grants from Southern California Edison and other partners. QCD already has six electric trucks, and Blanchett says another 39 are on the way.
We think this is actually a competitive advantage as we continue to transition.
Almost all of QCD's daily routes in Southern California are within 120 miles, a range current technology can handle on a single charge.
It made sense for our business.
And long term, Blanchett says the company expects savings on fuel and maintenance costs, and it plans to transition to a solar-powered charging system. California's rule is likely to have ripple effects across the nation, says UCLA climate policy expert Julia Stein.
I think we'll see other states kind of follow California's lead here.
That's what happened with California's rules on electric cars, which have been adopted by 17 other states.
Combined, that makes up about 40% of the U.S. market for passenger cars.
Stein expects a similar impact with medium and heavy-duty trucks. Back on the road, dialing up the radio in his truck, Buenrostro says he's aware he's at the cutting edge for his industry.
That's a benefit now with these trucks, you know, like, it's eco-friendly, you know, like it's new, people are scared of it, like, but it's the future.
One immediate benefit in this sweltering California summer, he says the truck's battery-powered engine is much cooler, not nearly as hot as the old diesel rigs he used to drive. In Fontana, California, I'm Aaron Stone for Marketplace.
Coming up.
There are some really high highs, really low lows. There are some big challenges. There are big wins.
I mean, that's life, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 158 points today, about 0.4%, 35,314. The NASDAQ down 110 points, nearly 0.8% there, 13,884. The S&P 500 subtracted 19 points, 0.4%. 44.99. As Justin Ho was telling us, Moody's cut the credit ratings for some regional banks, so let's check a couple of banks on that list, shall we? M&T Bank withdrew 1.4% today. Pinnacle Financial lowered 2.1%. Webster Financial down nearly 1%. Kimberly was telling us about that UPS earnings report. Well, here you go. UPS dropped off 0.8% today. Also in the delivery business, FedEx picked up about 1.4%. Another U.S. shipping company, XPO, added 1%. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus fell 4.02% on the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. At the risk of repeating myself from yesterday's show, these are not great economic days for China. Yesterday, we told you about its slow recovery from Xi Jinping's zero COVID policy. Today, more sour news. Beijing's exports were down 14.5% in July from a year earlier. That is the biggest drop since February of 2020, just as the global economy was going into the pandemic deep freeze. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has more on that.
China's exports have been falling steadily for the past year. Mary Lovely, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, says there are underlying reasons for that.
At the top of the list, clearly geopolitical tensions with the U.S., attempts to at least implement a China plus one strategy.
That's when businesses outside of China add at least one more country to its supply chain. It's something that's become more common after the pandemic manufacturing and shipping snarls. But Lovely says that's not the whole story. Because China is the world's top exporter, its trade data is a barometer for consumer spending. Categories that are up: electric vehicles, mostly exported to countries besides the U.S. Also,
suitcases, interestingly enough, because people are traveling again.
Suitcases, a product that's paired with services like flights and hotels. And services is a big factor behind China's export slowdown, because David Dollar, the senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, says that's what consumers are spending their money on right now.
People are out traveling, going to dinner, going to movies, going to see Barbie and Oppenheimer.
Of course, not exports of China. Meanwhile, Dollar says spending hasn't just shifted, it's slowed.
That's particularly true for the European Union, also for the United States.
The major buyers of Chinese goods. Ishwar Prasad, a professor of trade policy at Cornell, says China's not the only country with falling exports. It's happening across Asia. And that gives us a clue to what's happening with the health of the global economy. The verdict, according to him?
It's mostly gloom and a little bit of doom.
He says we're not nearing a worldwide recession yet.
But certainly it's very difficult to find signs of strength in the world economy right now.
Just when the economic news was on a positive track, a piece of data comes in to make things feel murky again. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
We're going to do a little anthropology now. Yes, anthropology, but really, it's a labor story. And we're going to do it in the form of a new paper from Kara Wall Scheffler at Seattle Pacific University and her colleagues. It's called The Myth of the Male Hunter, as in, and as we've all been told, the men are the hunters, the women are the gatherers. In fact, says Wall Scheffler, there is evidence of women as hunters in almost 80% of societies. And not only that, the women were doing it, carrying children on their backs, and with such skill that they actually had favorite weapons.
The day-to-day was something that I think we were pretty excited about. Up to this point, people had talked about women going out every day and opportunistically grabbing something if they saw it scuttle across their path. But when we went back to the original articles, the original literature, what we really found is that women were going out every day with the purpose of hunting, taking their favorite weapons with them, and that children don't just learn this when they turn 18. Children are learning this, learning their skills, you know, from the very beginning because they're going along on these expeditions with their parents.
So let me get all Marketplace on you here. This is about a gendered labor force, right? That's really what we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely.
So discuss for a little bit.
Okay.
Because, I mean, look, it exists to this day in this society, let alone, you know, thousands of years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, a couple of things. One, I think that we differentiate between big things that happen once or twice or three times a year that might be ritualistic. I kind of liken this to, you do have a really big meal at Christmas, but you don't have those big meals every single day. And those sort of day-to-day decisions about how people get little bits of food every day, those in many, not every, but in many cultures are done by women. And the women are doing all the different varieties of things. They're hunting, they're gathering, they're doing all of those little things every day. And yes, there might be some large scale, big events where everybody goes out all together and brings back something that can feed the entire group for one big feast. That's not the sort of day-to-day skills and labor that we see create a functioning society.
So with the acknowledgement that you're an anthropologist and not an economist, what this really is, it's about economic strategies, right?
That's
it's about
right.
how societies organize themselves to survive when there is oh so much work to be done.
Yeah.
And everybody's got to do it, right?
Yeah. And I think that the key thing, especially from an economic perspective, is that you have to be flexible. These strategies represent a dynamic community, not a community that says, well, that's not really your job today, so therefore we're just all not going to eat today. I mean, this is a situation where when things get lean, everybody goes out. The children are out. The parents are out. The grandmas, they're out, because that flexibility is what keeps people alive in a diverse and changing world.
Right. So what we really need to do is get away from the whole men are hunters and the women are gatherers thing, and just everybody's out there foraging, doing what it takes, right?
Yeah, I think it's worrisome. I might even say damaging to think that you are doing a task because you have evolved to do that task, and that therefore trying something new is going against your evolved purpose in life. Being flexible is your evolved purpose in life. That is what humans do. They are flexible to figure out how best to manage the health of their community. And sticking to some rigid notion of what that evolved duty is will prevent us then from sort of serving all of the members of our community.
Carol Wall-Scheffler is a professor of biology, also the co-chair of the Department of Biology at Seattle Pacific University. Thanks for your time, Professor. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Kai. Thanks for having me.
The pandemic did a real number on the music industry. Venues closed, musicians and producers and studio engineers were out of work for months at a time. Now, though, music is back. The superstars have been touring, of course. See also Beyonce and Taylor Swift. Indie artists, too, though. Even the really indie artists. That is today's installment of our series, My Economy.
I am Sarah King. I'm a musician, and I'm currently in Bozeman, Montana, but I am on the road this summer. I decided to become a musician full-time in the middle of the pandemic, actually, which is not a great time to decide to be someone whose job depends on putting a lot of people in small places. But I went full-time in September 2021, and I've been full-time since then. If I had to describe the touring situation in one word, roller coaster. I think because, yeah, there are some really high highs, really low lows. There are some big challenges. There are big wins. There are tons of people trying to tour after the pandemic when we couldn't really get out. You know, we're all singing to the little green dot on our computers for a while, and now everyone's out there touring. So it's been challenging. A lot of venues have a lot more artists trying to play shows than they have dates available. a lot of venues closed during the pandemic. And so that limits opportunities for like mid-level artists like me who might not, you know, I'm not at Taylor Swift level, so I'm not going to be selling those type of tickets. For this tour right now, I am touring by myself for the simple reason that it's the most financially sustainable way to tour, actually. So that is a little challenging because I am the driver. I am the, you know, the person who books the lodging. I'm the one who makes sure that we get food. I'm the one who makes sure that I get to the venue on time. So that is actually, I think, more challenging than traveling with a group. It is really challenging to cut through the noise. There's, you know, every day there's a new like, oh, try this TikTok trend or, you know, write a song like this. And I honestly don't think that it's worth trying to follow those trends. I think the better thing to cut through the noise is like stay true to yourself, write songs or play songs that have a lot of meaning to you. When I write a song that like is really meaningful for me and hits a lot of big emotions, those are the songs that people come up after and they're like, you made me cry. You made me feel something like, oh my goodness, I didn't even know I was holding on to that, you know? And that to me is what makes this worth it. And that's why I'm like, I have to keep doing this. I have to keep pursuing this.
That was Sarah King on tour somewhere on the roads of Montana. You know, this series only works with you and your help. So tell us what's going on in your economy, would you? You can do that at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out today, in which, I mean, okay. Subway, the sandwich place, has been running a contest of sorts, giving away free subs for life to one lucky winner who is willing to change their name legally to Subway. Anyway, in the first 96 hours after the giveaway was announced last month, more than 10,000 people have signed up to win, I guess, right? Again, it's free sandwiches for life, plus paying the expenses for the name change. One person will be chosen this month. Not for nothing, but it is worth a note here that the privately owned Subway is looking for a buyer. $9 billion is said to be the estimated price tag. All right, off we go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context, a possibly cautionary tale. Data from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York that shows credit card debt in this economy was up 4.6% last month to $1.03 trillion. Interest rates on those cards, as one need not remind, are way up as well. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mietten, and Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the Executive Director of Digital and On-Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama?, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.